From the studios of NPR West, I'm Tony Cox.
Listen to Prez. His tone, he swings. It's light, it's airy, it's genius. Even when he was hot playing up tempo, it was cool. You hear Lester playing Body and Soul, for example. Lester leaps in Indiana. I Got Rhythm, Ghost of a Chance, Polka Dots and Moonbeams, and it's just beautiful.
You gotta love it when a biographer is passionate about his subject. That's Douglas Daniels, author of Lester Leaps In, a biography of one of the most influential jazz musicians of all time, tenor saxophonist Lester Young.
He wouldn't play the melody of the composition. He'd create his own melody, and the creation was so powerful that when other people played that song, they played Lester's version of it rather than the original version.
In his book, Daniels describes Lester Prez Young as not only a brilliant musician, but also the strangest of birds, king of the hipsters, an architect of American counterculture who invented words and phrases like, that's cool and you dig. And since we've been talking about soldiers and veterans today, we give Daniels the mic to tell us more about Lester Young, particularly about what happened when the hippest cat in jazz was drafted into the Army during World War II. Here's Douglas Daniels on Lester Young.
Creative artists are often eccentrics. Michael Jackson, for example. Prince. Little Richard. And I could go on and on. Creative artists aren't the people who get up in the morning and go to work to be there at 8 or 9 and come home at 5. It doesn't work like that. So yes, he was eccentric, but he grew up in a world of eccentrics and artists, that is to say, vaudeville, and on the carnival minstrel circuit, which is known for its eccentrics. You know, the fat lady, the bearded lady, I don't know, the strong man, and so the sword swallower, and so forth and so on. But this is also a world of live and let live. Lester kind of took the golden rule, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, and gave his version of it. I don't bother nobody. And the reverse is, of course, is that nobody should bother me. But he found, as he got older, that people stared at him. Well, he did wear a pork pie after it was out of style, and he kind of liked a long black coat, which barnstormers wore. And he might have his hair in a little braid in back, for example. Like they say, he wore Cuban heels before they were in style. And he liked to wear what we now call hush puppies. And, of course, he smoked. He smoked marijuana daily. And he drank a fifth of liquor, at least a fifth, every day until he died or until he became very ill. He didn't believe in lying, for example. He would always tell the truth. He was very compulsive about that, which can make life very difficult. But then, too, as the family would point out, he was a rebel.
America in step for victory. America marshaling its energies for war. American soldiers at the front. A great civilian army lending them support behind the lines. Yes, the American people are determined that nothing shall stand in the way of total victory.
He was the top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowing reveille. He's the boogie-woogie bugle.
In the 1940s, a number of the white bands joined the military en masse, and they were given privileged positions to entertain and so forth. And the black bands during the war, like Basie band members, were alert to the fact that now with all these white bands gone, here's our chance to make some money. Because they never earned as much as the white bands, and they didn't get the airtime that white bands got, and they didn't play in the big downtown hotels the way white bands did. And so, rather than join up, they were glad to get money for their families to make up for the money that they had been denied, you might say, in earlier years. So whereas they were patriotic, they weren't as patriotic as some of the other bands because they knew as African Americans they would be treated differently in the military, just like they were treated differently in the music industry. But the Basie band kept moving, and he kept moving with it. This would have been in 44. Buck Clayton was drafted at some time in 43. Walter Page was drafted. The Army was getting at Basie band members, one after another. And finally, they caught up with Lester and Joe Jones at the Plantation Club way out south in Los Angeles. And a Zoot Suiter, I think he was wearing a white Zoot suit, was buying drinks for Lester and Joe Jones. And then that evening, he flashed a badge, FBI. If you don't show up for induction Monday morning, we're gonna come and get you. And then he left, and Lester was shocked. You know, he said, I liked a little SOB, you know? I liked him. How could he do this? So they reported for induction, and they were at Fort Ord for a period of time. But you'd be hard-pressed to find someone less suited for soldiering than Lester Young. He just didn't think like that. He'd say, somebody may knock me down and dirty my clothes, but I don't rumble. Red Callender said he was the most nonviolent man you ever met. Callender said, but to think of Lester Young with a gun and a bayonet plunging it into someone, he said, oh, that's just... And Lester, when he showed up for induction, showed up with his saxophone and a fifth of liquor, and he explained to them, you know, he drank and he smoked and so forth. But as some said, the military could be the army could be vicious, especially when it came to black people. They believed they could turn anybody into a soldier, a fighting man. So they took black men off and then shipped them down south, whereas white bands often got to play in on bases in California. And Lester was shipped to, I believe, Fort McClellan in Alabama. And one day, one of the officers noted that Lester wasn't behaving the way he thought a soldier should. And Lester confessed that he was high, and they found an ounce of marijuana on him. Then they searched his foot locker, and they found something that seemed to reek of alcohol and maybe some pills, some uppers or something like that. They also found a picture of his wife, and she was white, Mary Dale Young. And that infuriated the military brass, not to mention the drugs in this reefer madness era. So they court-martialed him. We have a transcript of the court-martial. And Lester, you could see, is not protesting, not claiming he's innocent. He's going along with them in every way. He's perfectly upfront, told them when he came in that he smoked and so forth, so he couldn't see what he had done wrong. So anyway, they court-martialed him, sentenced him to 5 years at hard labor. He spent a year instead in detention barracks in Alabama. And at the end of 1945, he was released. And some say he was a changed man after that. Other people would have cracked under the strain of court-martial, but Lester came out playing as strong as ever. After he came out of the military, Lester's star soared, and he was very popular. What he did was absorbed by the mainstream in about 4 or 5 years, because by the early 40s, all the tenor players were following Lester and sounding like Lester. White musicians as well as black musicians, people like Zoot Sims out here in Los Angeles. And, of course, they not only played like him, they dressed like him, they talked like him, they wore the pork pie. It said that Dexter Gordon stood in front of a mirror so that he could better mimic Prez's movements. Lester Young might start his solo with his horn vertical, and he'd end up with his horn horizontal like it was a flute, and other musicians did that. I think it was Brew Moore, tenor saxophonist, who said, anyone who doesn't play like Lester is just wrong. That's the degree to which Lester's heterodoxy became orthodoxy.
Douglas Daniels is author of Lester Leaps In, a biography of Lester Young. To listen to this show, visit NPR.org, where you can also order CDs and transcripts or call 877-NPR-TEXT. This is a news and opinion program created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. I'm Tony Cox. This is NPR News.